and now you want to cancel that out. You want to cancel the reactance, the capacitance, and the inductance, leaving a pure resistance feed point, and that's what they say. And I'm just adding those words in, by the way, reading what it says here. So you want a pure resistance, and they show you it in this figure. This requires the driven element to be insulated from the boom, and because the current balance in the driven element is important, an RF choke balun or current balun is required to isolate the feed line from the antenna. Yep, I can see that also in this particular case. So you will require a balun to match this because of the unbalances or imbalances of this particular match. All right, that's basically it for this. That kind of like wraps it up. The references and tools, and Roy, if you want to write this down, it says here to really learn how to design and apply the techniques described in these three articles. He mentioned three articles. This is actually one article. Follow up with the notes and references given in each section, each article section. In addition, the ARRL periodicals archive, www.arrl.org /ARRL periodicals -archive-search. Okay, I'm saying it once, but I'll repeat it again.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, let me get it back, WHCDL. When I give it back to Roy, I can repeat this information. Roy wants to write it down. So this particular website lists related articles from QST, QEX, NCJ, and Ham Radio magazines. Okay, so you can look at that archive website, and you can see where all this stuff is. Most have books for students of impedance matching, including Transmission Line Transformers by Jerry Sivix, W2FMI. By the way, there's a really good book that he came out with. I don't own any, but I've glanced at a few, and I should buy one, but I never did. Unfortunately, Jerry is no longer with us, but he's done a lot of good work and came up with some really good books on this kind of topic. So Jerry Sivik, W2FMI, and any edition of Reflections by Walter Maxwell, of course that's a very popular book too, and that was W2DU, Walter Maxwell. Online resources abound, including two of my favorites. There's another one, RF Cafe. Sounds like something I could eat. You know, go to the RF Cafe, www.rfcafe.com. www.rfcafe.com. And Microwaves 101, www.microwaves101.com, which feature numerous tutorials and calculator utilities. Okay, so you can go to those websites and get all the rest of the information that we didn't talk about. Okay, with that ends this discussion of impedance matching. It was a long, long, drawn-out, multi-week discussion, but I think we learned a lot. I did, for sure. And a lot more to learn. But you always learn something new in this hobby, so it's a good thing. Any questions? Well, Roy, I'll get back to you first on the website. If you want to repeat them. And that's it. For now, EC2GS, WHCDL, in Andy's Corner.
Yes, thank you very much, Andy. If you could send me them by email, because there was a bit more of them than I could scribble down. So I've written down a few, but if you have some free time at some point or another, just pack them up in an email, and I'll double-check them and put them on the link page.
Okay, I shall do that. Very good.
question, WS2N.
And another question, N1YDY.
Okay, that Hank, luckily I know names. Hopefully I know everybody's names. Paul and Hank, in that order. Paul, go ahead. How you doing?
Looking at the one thing that you were talking about, the Delta picture. You know, I have the book, so, you know, it's figure three, and it's got a picture of the Delta hookup. I'm wondering about that little piece that sticks out. You'll see it says D or D1, a little piece that sticks out. I know that's part of the Delta match, because I have that on my 2-meter beam. You know, I had to put it at a certain spot, you know, when I bought the antenna, with this piece, that little piece sticking out. I'm just wondering, that, you know, is that piece part of the radiating system? Could you actually cut that off and there would be no difference? Or is that part of this whole radiating system? I'm not going to cut it off. I'm just curious about, what that... They tell you to put it at a certain location. You know, you might have an inch or 2 inches sticking out, you know. But once that's done, couldn't you actually theoretically just cut that piece off? That's not really doing anything for radiation, is it, Andy?
From what I see and the way I'm interpreting this, it says D or D1, which actually it's showing the spacing between the driven element, which is D or D2, to the adjustable element, because that's the one, well, you adjust both, but the coaxial element, where the coax is feeding the driven element, there's a certain spacing between, so it looks like the arrows as D and D1. Technically, I would think that they have that as to show it, because you could extend it out if you want to change the impedance, whatever the impedance is. You have enough room. See, if they didn't show that, then if you were to bring that movable bar across, moving it further to the right, you're going to no longer be connected to that part that connects to the coax cable. So they have to show it, so it shows you can slide it back and forth. That's what it's there for. If you are matched where it's shorter than the actual length of that, at that particular point, then you're not going to change it. You're never going to change it. Yeah, you can cut the rest of it off. It's not going to make any difference at that point. But there's no reason to. So they show it that way because you could adjust it. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, they're really talking about HF. I mean, that piece could be relatively long. Actually, for my 2-meter beam, it's just a, you know, I think the whole piece is probably maybe 8 inches long, and you just adjust it to where they told you, probably an inch and a half or something sticking out. But, okay, it's just, yeah, if you wanted to make a change, you go one way or another, you can. Very good, good answer. Thank you, Andy. Back to you.
I don't think it's that much longer for an HF beam as opposed to a 2-meter beam, because I see both. You know, I don't know the exact dimensions, but, you know, given the way it's designed, you're not going to have a gamma match that's a feet, and, you know, many feet long that you have to move it, you know, quite a long length just to make it match. If it's that far off, then there's something else going on. Because they, you know, they design it so it's in the ballpark range of the impedance at the frequencies, and then you just fine-tune it. And that's what it's for. I would say for fine-tuning. Maybe even a finer tuning could be another adjustment. So that's how I look at it, anyway. Okay, very good. Thanks. Let's see, Hank, you're next. N1YDY, WHCDF.
Thank you, Andy. Before we get going on the question, are we using the ARRL antenna book? Is that where you're reading out of?
Oh, you know, I forgot to mention that when I started. I always mention it, and I forgot about it. I'm reading this out of QST, November 2019. The article, I didn't even mention that, which I again normally do. I'm sorry about that. It's an article that says it's an article about impedance matching with transmission lines by Ward Silver N0AX in November 2019 QST. And I should have mentioned that, and I forgot to.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, I'm looking at the a gamma match diagram that's in the antenna handbook, and I think that Paul might have asked the same question. There's a little bit of a stub that sticks out past the shorting rod on a gamma match. Is that what he was talking about?
I would think I don't have the antenna handbook here in front of me. Yes, I would think this is probably taken from that, you know, given that the references are referring to those books, the antenna book and so on. Yes, that's what he's referring to, and that's what I just, explained.
Okay, well, here's where I'm a little confused. If you have one side of the coax feeding the gamma match, and then you have the other side of the coax feeding the driven element, there's a shorting stub, and I'm not really sure how the shorting stub works, since the distance between the shorting stub and the center of a beam, the driven element on a beam, is shorter than the quarter wavelength for the antenna, or at least it is in my 2-meter beam case that I'm physically looking at. So I'm trying to understand exactly how a gamma match works. Is there something about where that shorting stub shorts to the driven element that is pretty unique?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would have to get into that antenna book and get into the nitty gritty of how it's described. This basically is, in this article here, it's just giving the surface about it. Basically, you know, the way I see it as this gamma match, it's like a tapped inductor. And you want to set the coax cable, the center of the coax, at some point on that tapped inductor. Given that the driven element goes through a coil on the base of the coil, and then the other side of the coil goes to ground, which is the grounded side of the coax cable, and there's a certain point where you're going to be tapping on that coil. It's a little bit more of an effect because now you have a capacitance between the driven element and that coaxial line that you're shorting at different points. So it's a little bit more involved. I've seen some formulas on it, and they're rather complex. But I'm trying to simplify it by using a mobile antenna, which I recently took apart. And there's a coil on the base. The coax comes in and is tapped on a portion of that coil. A certain location on that coil is where the coax cable is connected to. The bottom of the cable goes to ground, actual ground. So the antenna is grounded itself. If you put an ohmmeter from the antenna to the chassis, you'll see it dead short. But it's going through an inductor. And that's how they match that particular base of the whip antenna, the mobile antenna. That's basically how I could describe it. I could get out the other books and get more into depth, but I'm trying to stay away from all the math and everything else that's involved because of obvious reasons. right now, does that help a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's some things are easier to visualize than others. I certainly can visualize how get an impedance matching coil for an N-fed vertical, which is what you're describing on your mobile antenna. And the same is true with, those old ARX antennas that Chris Kraft used to make, where, you know, it had a big loop and the feed line came out and half of it went up and half of it went down, depending upon where you put it on that big loop, so that, you know, a one-turn inductor, essentially. But when I look at a gamma match, I just have a hard time seeing the, you know, the transformer part of it in my mind. I've read it, read the theory a few times, and, you know, I'm just a little bit defective. I can't quite figure it out, even when I've got the book in front of me. But thanks for help. It does, it did help, and, you know, I'll figure it out someday before I die, I'm sure.
Okay, make sure you don't die first, but... Well, like I said, you know, this article is it's talking about it as an overview to show you what a gamma match looks like. You know, it's basically a pictorial, and you can see, you know, because they're showing here in this particular, you know, QST magazine, they're showing the delta match, the T match, the gamma match, and the what's the last one? I mentioned beta match, but it doesn't say actually beta itself. And these are matches that are usually on the boom of a beam antenna, all of them. Well, you know, these four that they're showing here. You know, without getting into the, you know, the electrical discussion on the engineering side of how it's actually designed as compared to what it looks like. Because, yeah, it's true. You look at something, it's hard to figure out what's going on. You know, they have to get into a little bit deeper discussions, you know, which in this particular case, I'm avoiding. I'm just going into the overview. So I'm just keeping that in mind because it's even hard for me to answer the questions on that level. All right. Any other comments about that? Just give it back to you, WHCDO.
Yeah, you know, when you look at beta matches and hairpin matches, you can visualize how they work. I'm just having trouble visualizing how the gamma worked. But thanks very much. I do appreciate it. And when Whitey Y is clear.
You and me both are in the same boat. Okay, Hank, thanks. Roy, let's see. Any other questions? Then I'll give it back to Roy. Okay, so that completes Andy's Corner for tonight, and I'll see if I can come up with some more interesting articles. Again, you know, QEX magazine, which I have some. I don't have a subscription at this time, but you want to get into some really, you know, technical discussions, you read QEX magazine, and that gets into some deep stuff. The problem with that, you know, getting into something deeper would take up the whole TechNet. And they wouldn't have time for anyone else, like Paul or anyone, you know, if he hit into something that's really, really deep. So we're trying to avoid that as a basic overview again. All right, that's it. 73. Catch you next time. AC2GS, WHCDO.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. That was a great presentation. I look forward to future Andy's Corners. And to Hank, I found a interesting article from QST back in 1969 that gives a circuit equivalent to gamma matches. You might find it interesting. I put it on the link page, roy.ac2gs.com.
Okay, thanks. I'll take a look for it. And one Whitey White.
Very good. That's the beauty of technical articles. They last long times. They don't get become irrelevant. And QST has loads of those. And QEX is a fascinating magazine. I get it as well. It's a bit esoteric. It's rather obvious that there are electrical engineers writing on somewhat esoteric subjects. The mathematics sometimes can give people a nosebleed, but nowadays, if you're a member of the ARRL, they throw in an electronic version of QEX for free. So if you have any kind of electronic device, you can log into the ARRL and take a look through QEX. That's a bargain. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. And We're still going strong here, started in 1982, and just keeps on going. If you have any questions of a technical nature or scientific nature or even a medical generalized nature, or you want to ask something about COVID or something else, please, this is the time. So give me your first name and your call sign.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
I don't know if we have time tonight. Do you have any comment on the $50 fee that's coming up, over?
Well, being a fellow amateur radio operator with a disdain for spending unnecessary funds of money, I find it rather annoying that the FCC went from totally free to the idea of $50. True, if you want to think of it in the long term, it's $50 every 10 years, so it's a $5 a year license, which is relatively inexpensive. But I think they really didn't indicate the reason or rhyme. I don't exactly know what we get for our money. At this point, it's a little more than a entry in a database. So I think it's a bit hard-handed. I think if they wanted to remonetize license fees, they could have started significantly lower and just worked their way up over the long haul. I have a little bit of disdain for the FCC these days as far as listening to complaints. There were a whole bunch of issues that there were a lot of people upset with rule changes. And they kind of played games with those comments to the point that they're having a lot of investigations in that. So I don't think they're going to listen to us. I wish they would. And I think it's a wee bit too much money, but I don't think they're going to care.
Comment in one way, do I?
Yes, certainly, Hank.
In the mid-90s, the FCC tried this with recreational boaters. The government had just gone to a luxury tax, so on boats that were a certain dollar value and above, and I think it was a pretty high dollar value, I can't quite remember anymore. I think it was about $150,000. And they went to a mandatory fee for using a VHF radio and didn't listen to the comments during the public comment time. But there was so much complaint about it over time that they eventually dropped it again. So it did exist, and the marine community cried bloody murder, and over the period of time they responded to that and dropped it.
Well, I hope history repeats itself. The FCC has had license fees in the past. I'm sure people who've been in the hobby longer than me are well aware of that. For some strange reason, the FCC decided to not charge anyone for anything because there was also a charge for a vanity call sign because their accountants had done the figuring and it just cost them too much money to ask for money. So their option was to either make the costs almost prohibitive or make them free. And in a brilliant idea, they decided to make it free. Again, I'm not quite sure what the point of this exercise. Do they plan on balancing the budget on these $50 fees? I do not think so. Also, I'd like to know if we're getting any better service if we hand over the $50. I also don't think so. So I'm a little reticent. Hopefully, our fellow hams will notify the FCC of our disdain. Unfortunately, if history repeats itself shorter term, Ashut Pai is not going to read any stuff that we write, and we'll probably have some guy in computer sciences fake a lot of comments that says that he'd like to pay a $100 fee. So, I don't know. I'm not terribly optimistic in the short haul. Maybe in the long.
Well, if I can finish, the reason they dropped the fee for the recreational boaters it wasn't the end users, the end voters that were successful at complaining. It was the industry that said you're killing the industry, and we're not getting the recreational voters to even show up. And so that's the reason, you know, the dollar, but it was monetized against the the dollar sign of the industry rather than the end user. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but I think you know what I mean. And one whitey white clear.
Okay, that makes sense. Although I would imagine the ultra high premium boat building industry in the United States has a bit of money in their coffers. I'm not quite sure if ICOM America or Yaesu America or Kenwood America has that much in their slush fund. So I don't know. I don't know if that's going to have an impact. I always got the sense that amateur radio manufacturers might be making a decent living at the end of the day, but none of them are getting terribly rich off of us.
Well, there was that whole history of Yaesu and Motorola that pretty much made your point.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. Every so often I'll have the opportunity to talk to someone who is in the marketing and especially in the accounting portion of the business. And they basically just make enough to get by. It's kind of sad. It may be one of the reasons why innovation takes a little bit longer for the most part, and why startup companies tend to be a lot more innovative, because, you know, as long as they're starting from zero, they have no legacy stuff to save themselves some cash. So it's an unfortunate aspect of the hobby. You would sort of think that the United States has a record number of licensed amateur radio operators, 750,000 people. But unfortunately, a lot of them are guys and gals with tech licenses. And maybe if they have a radio, and some I'm sure don't, it's a Balfong, you know, something they picked up on Amazon or Walmart or something. So although I would love to see a much more vital industry, and, you know, every so often the different companies come up with new models, so that's nice. But still, there's an obvious – this is not Apple, you know. None of these companies are going to report $1 trillion in assets at some point in their lives. But, you know, we get by, thankfully. We have a few companies that keep producing stuff. And it keeps us happy to a degree.
The US 2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, out of those 700,000 hams, there's plenty of them that help out during these wildfires, or you listen to the some of these reports that, you know, that come across the radio talking about people lost at sea, and some ham helps them out, and storms and disasters and earthquakes. And, you know, I wonder what it would cost, you know, to have a service installed to be able to do that. I think that would cost a few more dollars for the federal government to do that than having a bunch of hams running around. I think that would be a little bit more expensive. To actually start charging people that are volunteering for things is kind of absurd. Back to you, Roy.
I would agree with you, and the case has been made, I'm sure, via the ARRL and other emergency organizations of the value that we give the community. Sometimes that's effective. Again, Ajit Pai, I don't really see him. You know, if you're a multi-billion dollar company, then he would certainly want to listen to you or me. But the average Joe Ham, I don't think he factors that into the equation. I'm not even seeing what the point of this exercise might be. You know, there was absolutely no hint of it until they published their bright idea about this out of nowhere. And Ajit Pai really hasn't bothered to comment on it one way or the other. So I don't think it's a rational plan based upon rational precepts. I think there's something else going on someplace else, and we just ended up getting a $50 bill sent to us just for the heck of it.
KD2HUC with the comment.
Yes, HUC.
I'm reading the AWRL article on this right now, and the FCC's justification is the maintenance and upkeep of the ULS, the Universal Licensing System. So that's what they're blaming it on, which really isn't fair because the ULS covers most, of the radio services, not just HAM. So I wonder if this is going to be across the board for everybody. KD2HUC, back to next.
Okay, I mean, that's as good as a vague reason as any. I think I read that, too. The ULS is a glorified database on a server. I don't think that, do the math. Three-quarters of a million times 50. I think that probably the cost of the portion of the ULS that's used to record our status is maybe, I don't know, one-twentieth, one-thirtieth of the other entries. So I'm not quite seeing that as a legitimate reason. I mean, they have to buy a new computer, so they're charging everyone $50 a pop. That could make a lot of servers. I don't think they really have that many servers doing that, but it's as good a reason, I guess, for them as any. They're not going to really tell you what the machinations are going on in the back room there. Oh, well, it's sort of a shame. I think it's a done deal personally. I can't recall in the last 2-3 years Ashutpai ever kind of going back on any bright idea he and his agency promotes. So I think everyone should save up their nickels and dimes for the next time that their license needs to be renewed. Anyone else with any comments on this particular subject, please?
No, whiskey after you finish.
Okay, Wes, I haven't forgotten you. I just want to make sure that everyone has asked and answered whatever they wanted. We still got 45 minutes before it's time for a poll in the SpaceNet report. So I just want to once again ask if anyone out there has any questions or topics that they would like to bring to the technical net tonight. Yes, NY2JJ.
Simple technical question. What do you get when you superimpose an FM transmission over an AM transmission?
Gee, that's a messy thing. So you basically have an FM signal and an AM signal. If you have an FM demodulator, you get the FM back out. If you have an AM a demodulator, I would imagine you get a messy version of the AM signal out.
You expect the FM signal would be clean.
Yes, because you're not going to get the frequency modulation effect from the AM.
You're going to get some on slope.
Yeah, you'll get some, but I think you'll get a bigger mess on the AM signal than you will on the FM.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, I think the FM would have a limiter circuit on it, which would mitigate any AM effect.
Yeah, I mean, frequency modulation has its benefits. It also has its prices. It is not as energy efficient as you know, amplitude modulations, kissing cousin single sideband. But it has the ability of full capture and low background noise. There's a lot of nice aspects to frequency modulation as opposed to amplitude modulation. But, you know, all the forms of modulation, amplitude, frequency, phase, are interesting. They all have their pluses and their minuses. Say again, your signal got cut off.
And that was quick and easy. Thanks. NYC Chicken.
You're welcome. I'm glad we got to answer your question. And if you have any further ones in the future, you know where we'll all be. Once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone has any questions or topics that they would like to knock around tonight, let me know.
Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think you're going to discuss the superconductivity at room temperature. I don't think that.
Okay, we can do that. I'll pull it up someplace I have it, and I'll present it.
They've been working on that for decades, and if that's really true, that would be a big advancement.
Well, you know, this is the first study. There'll be people who question it. There'll be people who test it themselves. And, of course, there's a price to be paid. It would be nice if I could tell you that it had this bar of material and at room temperature it was superconducting, but there are some limitations. I'll drop for a second, and then I'll give you the little presentation I had on this subject. Okay. Scientists have reported the discovery of the first room temperature superconductor after more than a century of waiting. Scientists have found that the first superconductor that operates at room temperature, at least given a fairly chilly room now. The material is superconducting below temperatures of about 15 degrees Celsius. To us Americans, that's 59 degrees Fahrenheit. Physicist Ranga Dias of the University of Rochester in New York and colleagues reported this October 14th in the magazine Nature. However, the new material's superconducting superpower appears only at extremely high pressures, limiting its practical usefulness at this point. Dias and colleagues formed the superconductor by squeezing carbon, hydrogen, and sulfur between the tips of two diamonds and hitting the material with laser light to induce a chemical reaction. At a pressure of about 2.6 million times that of Earth's atmosphere, and temperatures below about 15 degrees centigrade, the electrical resistance vanished. That alone wasn't enough to convince Dias. Quote, I didn't believe it the first time, he says, so the team studied additional samples of the material and investigated its magnetic properties. Superconductors and magnetic fields are known to clash. Strong magnetic fields inhibit superconductivity. Sure enough, when the material was placed in a magnetic field, lower temperatures were needed to make it superconducting. The team also applied an oscillating magnetic field to the material and showed that when the material became a superconductor, it expelled that magnetic field from its interior, which is another sign of superconductivity. Let me drop for a sec. The scientists were not able to determine the exact composition of the material or how the atoms were arranged, making it difficult to explain how exactly it is superconducting at such a relatively high temperature. Future work will focus on describing the material itself more completely. When superconductivity was discovered in 1911, it was found only at temperatures close to absolute zero. That's about minus 273.15 degrees centigrade. But since then, researchers have steadily uncovered materials that superconduct at higher and higher temperatures. In recent years, scientists have accelerated that progress by focusing on hydrogen-rich material at high pressure. In 2015, physicist Michael Emmert of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Mainz, Germany, and colleagues squeezed hydrogen and sulfur to create a superconductor at temperatures of minus 70 degrees centigrade. A few years later, two groups, one led by Eremetz and another involving Helmley and physicist Madhuri Somalu, studied a high-pressure compound of lanthium and hydrogen. The two teams found evidence of superconductivity at even higher temperatures of minus 23 degrees centigrade and minus 13 degrees centigrade, respectively, and in some samples, possibly as high as 7 degrees centigrade. If room-temperature superconductors could be used at atmospheric pressures, it would save vast amounts of energy lost to resistance in electrical grids. And it could improve current technology, from MRI machines to quantum computers to magnetically levitated trains. Diaz envisions that humanity could become a superconducting society. But so far, scientists have created only specks of the material at very high pressures, so practical applications are still a long way off. Still, the temperature is not a limit anymore. To create room temperature superconductors that work without putting a squeeze, they say, is the next big step that they have to do. So that's that story. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Very good, Roy, WS2N. Very good. Well, looks like a long time before we find it on a real in Home Depot, but very good. At least they're going in the right direction.
Yeah, as the old saying goes, you got to crawl before you walk, and walk before you run, and run before you develop the warp drive. So it's fascinating. It's going to lead to a lot of interesting theoretical papers suggesting what the heck this compound really is, and even better yet, how it works. Right now, there are two types of superconductors. The original superconductors that were found at near absolute zero are called type 1. The ones that operate at a little bit warmer than absolute zero are designated type 2. There's been a lot of theoretical research, and people are trying to figure out exactly how even these superconductors do their magic. Part of the theory involves things called Cooper pairs of electrons, where two different electrons become equivalent and lose their resistance between each other. So it's a fascinating field, and it looks like it's going in the right direction. Hopefully they'll be able to sustain it with some materials that will not require diamonds and laser beams. Any other questions or comments on this particular story? Okie doke. Wes, you wanted to tell us something?
That takes me. I have a short news, science news report, if you don't mind.
Okay, but pause between the stories and give us an opportunity to, you know, comment if we feel that a comment is warranted.
The first update is going to be just mentioned, and we have a space report that is going to cover it more deeply. Water was discovered a few days ago on Sunnyside of the moon, and it was by using SOFIA, which is a Boeing specially prepared telescope that was flying, and the scientists were able to discover molecules of water. So I'm going to stop at that point, and the in-space report, you're going to probably hear more about it. Okay. The white paint keeps surfaces cooler than surroundings, even under direct sun. And we have a School of Mechanical Engineering of Purdue University in Indiana. This is not one story about them. We have two stories about them. Let me drop. Scientists have developed a white paint that cools below the temperature of its ambient surrounding, even under direct sunlight. The research published October 21 is in the journal Cell Reports Physical Science, demonstrates a radiative cooling technology that could be used in commercial paints that could be less expensive to manufacture and then possibly reflects 95.5% of the sunlight that reaches the surface back in outer space. In contrast, commercial heat-rejecting paints currently on the market only reflect at maximum 80% of solar irradiation and cannot achieve below ambient temperatures. So we have a possible applications that could eliminate air conditioning in some of the areas, or at least use of air conditioners in some of the parts of the year that we usually use them. We're talking about end of the summer, and we're talking about the early summer, early summer, where the temperature is rapidly rising. Zinc bar is still not set in high areas. But even though, if we have a heat at its full power, that paint will help a lot. It is a persistent task to develop a below-ambient radiative cooling solution that offers a convenient single-layer particle matrix paint from form and high reliability, and that is the statement of School of Mechanical Engineering at Purdue University in Indiana. To develop a commercially applicable radiative cooling paint, the team of scientists used calcium carbonate filters and air abundant compound that is present everywhere instead of standard titanium dioxide particles, since the fillers have large band gaps, energy differences between the valence electron band and the bottom on the conducting electron band. That help minimize the amount of ultraviolet light to the that paint absorbs. The researchers also leverage a high particle concentration of 60% which boosts sunlight scattering as well as broad particle size distribution instead of single particle size for efficient broadband scattering. And some information about its features. There was a test done in West Lafayette, Indiana, for over 2-day period. The paint sample remained at 10 degrees Celsius below ambient temperature at night and at least 1.7 Celsius below the temperature of the ambient surrounding when the sun was at its zenith. The cooling power was shown to exceed 37 watts per square meter. And that was under direct sun. And there was an infrared camera that was used to measure the calcium carbonate-based acrylic paint that was able to maintain lower temperature under direct sun than its commercial counterpart. So that is a very much promising for commercial buildings, data centers, warehouses, food storage, automobile, outdoor electrical equipment, military infrastructures, and utility vehicles. The paint may be applied directly to buildings to reduce cooling costs, since the paint lacks metallic components. Telecommunication companies may use it to prevent outdoor equipment from overheating, especially with 5G network. But think, guys, about your own roofs. And how much money you can save on it. Any questions?
Well, I would like to make a couple of comments on it because I read the story as well.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, basically what's going on is temperatures tend to equilibrate in environments. Temperature is either transferred from convection or conduction or radiation. So this paint is an example of a radiative emissive material as opposed to many white pigmented paints. It also works with the UV lights and infrared and improves the emissive qualities so that the heat is dissipated by radiation outside. The problem is that, of course, keeping it clean, because if it gets dirty, it becomes a less effective emitter and it starts to absorb the heat. And ultimately, I don't think, unless it's a very borderline environment, that you'll need no refrigeration or air conditioning. I think, though, it might decrease the cost of air conditioning in a building that's coated with this particular material. But it is a fascinating thing. It's a readily available material, so it's not going to be cost prohibitive, and it's easily recycled. So I'm looking forward to their bringing that into production and see how that works.
I have a problem with your explanation. Think about 95% of efficiency, then we have a 5% of rate in the time frame that the temperature is changing. So think about refrigeration, 5% of 95% of efficiency constant. How much less of the energy do you need per hour to run your refrigerator or your air conditioner?
Well, you know, 5% difference to me is not a heck of a lot. And unfortunately, not all of the heat dissipation is from direct illumination from the sun. There's the convection and conduction. There is equipment in these enclosures that generate their own temperatures. So, again, I think it's a good move in the right direction. I don't think any factory is going to throw out their air conditioning system when they slap some paint on the outside of their building.
Any other questions? A giant hornet has invaded Washington State and is hungry for honeybees. It's a killer. It's a killer of the human being as well. The Asian giant hornet, a 2-inch menace that feasts on honeybees, has invaded Washington State. It migrated from Canada, where the colony was discovered nesting in the ground, but it's not the Canadian creature. It's Asian creature. And now we're coming back to Purdue University pest tracker. So we have another story about Purdue University, Indiana. They were able to catch them. We don't know how many of them are still left. But say two or three of the hornets could easily kill bees in few nests per day. So we're talking about a huge danger to our society, and also it's lethal to the human being. I didn't read how many people could be able to survive that, but it's a danger. The resident found the nearly 2-inch hornet in Blaine, a city that sits on the U.S.-Canada border. The Washington State Department of Agriculture reported the department took the specimen, which had died, and they sent it to Purdue. And they were able to, I don't know how, were they using a space chemical suit? But when you look at the picture, and Dr. Roy, you can quickly Google for it, you see, or especially the videos, you see people who are dressed like a space suit, special, a very thick rubber costume. And they show how they got them all, but we don't know how many of them are still there. So we're talking about the pandemic, but then we're talking about another thing that if we lose control on it, could be deadly. Dr. Roy.
AC2GS. Well, one of the reasons why they're much bulkier dressed than beekeepers is these little suckers have stingers that are a quarter of an inch long. They are nasty creatures. They're of Asian origin, and like most things, unfortunately, over time, they hitched a ride, went up to Canada, and are now dropping down below the border. And my understanding is that they, luckily, they found a colony. They vacuumed the colony entirely. They do not know if there are other colonies, but I'm sure they're looking for them. So this is going to be a problem. Introducing foreign life into a ecosystem is fraught with problems. Occasionally, human beings bring it on themselves. They have a pest, and they want to deal with the pest, so they introduce a foreign life form, which is the idea is to eat the pest, but then they find out after the fact that it also eats a whole bunch of other things, and it becomes a mess. So, yes, the Asian giant hornet, or all the more colorful terms for it, is a problem that we are going to have to address in the future.
Using a new type of traps, WSDA researchers tagged several captured hornets with radio trackers, which they used to lead them to the nest. Asian giant hornets typically nest in the ground, but can occasionally be found nesting in the dead trees. The scary part is that although it's 22nd of October, they were discovered, but they were also discovered for the first time in Washington State in December of 2019. So to find them was an easy task. Let me go to the next stop. We have a Google that decided to invest very small sum of money, which is a $5 million, along with government, to work on a artificial intelligence to monitor climate changes and air changes in the next 3 years. I don't have much about it, but also a Canadian decided that they're going to do their own $5 million Canadian dollars finding. And they were actually the first one because they did it at June 18, 2020.